Welcome to the Science, Microbes, and Health podcast, covering emerging topics and challenges in the fields of probiotics, prebiotics, synbiotics, postbiotics, and fermented foods. This is the podcast of the International Scientific Association for Probiotics and Prebiotics, known as ISAP, a nonprofit scientific organization dedicated to advancing the science of these fields. Check us out at www.isapscience.org. I'm Dr. Mary Ellen Sanders, ISAP's Executive Science Officer. I hope you enjoy this episode with your hosts from the ISAP Board of Directors, Professor Colin Hill and Professor Dan Tancredi.
Hello, everybody. My name is Colin Hill.
And I'm Daniel Tancredi.
And on today's podcast, we're really privileged to have three guests, all who were there at the inception of ISAP. So we've got Irene Lenoir-Vincoop, we've got Mary Ellen Sanders, and we've got Glenn Gibson. So three amazing guests. And what we're going to really ask you about is that moment or that period where ISAP was founded, what the intention was when you founded it, and has it realized what you dreamed of back then, I guess. So Irene, I want to congratulate you first. This week you were conferred with your PhD, and we're thrilled to hear that that happened and congratulate you on that. I know you were instrumental to the setting up of ISAP because I've heard the stories, but can you tell us, in your view, how did ISAP come about and why was there a need for such an organization?
So in fact, ISAP was conceived in 1999, in autumn 99, when I met with Glenn and Mary Ellen in a hotel in New York to discuss about the organization of a symposium that we planned for the year after, for 2000. And so we had a kind of brainstorming, organizing meeting. But then after that meeting, the three of us stayed a bit longer. Perhaps we all had the time before jumping on our planes. I don't remember. And then we started to talk about the idea of, well, kind of exploring the interest during this 2000 meeting about setting up a working group on probiotics and prebiotics. We were not very ambitious or pretentious. We said, well, it might just be an interest group that then could adhere to a scientific society or a kind of umbrella federation or whatever. And but that was the real very, very beginning of ISAP. And of course, then it was a lot of work for the 2 years after. Because for me, as an industrial person, I succeeded to be kind of persuasive enough to get the starting grant, which was important. But if you only have a grant and you don't do the rest, you can't go much further. And I remember Mary Ellen, and I think she has been working an awful lot on the bylaws for a long period of time before we really had the possibility to get ISAP going.
Yeah, I want to come to Mary Ellen in a moment, because obviously I think her energy is central to ISAP. But Glenn, what are your memories of that same time and that moment?
Not that much different to Irene's, really, Colin. We were involved in a board for putting together a conference on fermented foods, which Irene was running, and Mary Ellen, myself, and a couple of other people were the committee putting together speakers for this. And I think we were just sitting having coffee while we were planning this, and somebody said, you know what, there's no real home for pro and prebiotic research. It tends to be brought into nutrition societies, microbiology societies, food science societies, and it seems a bit sort of splattered all over the place, or disparate, for want of a better word. And so we wondered whether we might think about developing an organization solely dedicated to pro and prebiotics. I think at first it was only going to be probiotics, and then we expanded it to pre as well. And so we kind of got Irene a few strong drinks and asked her if she could find a grant from Danone to help kickstart this all along. And in parallel with that, we would ask a few people in the field, like yourself, people like Dan as well, and Chris, what they felt, whether they felt this was a worthwhile venture or not. And so when the meeting that we were planning actually came into realization, which was about a year later, as Irene said, in the year 2000, we had a breakfast session where people would come in and give us their views on to whether this would work out or not, and what we could do, who could be involved, the format of it. And we expected, you know, 5 or 6 people just to pop in, but I think there was something like 30, 40 that did so. And that was a significant percentage of the total attendees for this conference. So we then felt there was something in it. And it kind of went from there, and we put together a board of directors and then planned the first ISAP meeting, or ISAP, anyway.
We all call it ISAP, but you say that it's the international, so it should be ISAP. But ISAP, we're going to call it.
I don't think it matters too much, Colin. No.
One thing that mattered a great deal, though, was that ISAP always had prebiotics influence. Was that because we were fortunate enough to have one of the fathers of prebiotics, Glenn Gibson, there at the founding?
No, you always get these people who were a pain in the neck and never let things go down, don't you? But I don't know. Marcel Robefroy was also involved in the early days. I don't think that was a big driver, really. And I've always felt during all the years of ISAP that, you know, there has been the often implied criticism that prebiotics don't get an equal weighting to probiotics. And I've never really bought into that. I've always felt it's been entirely fair throughout all the years we've been doing this. And for instance, if you look at the amount of research papers available on probiotics, it's huge. On prebiotics, it isn't. So, you know, you're never going to get a 50-50 weighting because of that alone. But I think basically the small committee which we put together at the start felt that to have both concepts in there would be worthwhile, even though there was more evidence for one than the other.
And then, Mary Ellen, of course, you your memories of the same event would be nice to hear. But can you also elaborate on why you felt there was a need for such a thing?
Yeah, it's hard to remember back to this time, but there were no probiotic meetings back then. They didn't exist. And as Colin alluded to, there were probiotic talks that would be given here and there at other disciplines meetings. And so we really wanted to find a home for the multidisciplinary efforts, including the microbiologists and the clinicians and the food technologists and the biochemists and the people that were all interested in this area. And I think we succeeded in doing that. And, you know, shortly after we started the organization, probably within 5 years, these kinds of meetings became much more commonplace where you started seeing these. But before then, there was no home for people to get together and talk about this field in general.
The first time we met was in Spain when I invited you for a symposium that was on fermented food fermentation and intestinal flora. But the term probiotics was indeed not, and even the meeting we have set up in New York in 2000 was on functional dairy products. Mm-hmm. So we were kind of turning around this whole concept. And of course, we should not forget that the definition, the very first definition of probiotics, only came out in 2001. So that was afterwards.
And the origin of ISAP came from donation from Danon and through URN. And of course, ISAP is a very big industry membership now. And how do you walk that line between being funded by industry, but not being just a mouthpiece for industry, trying to protect the real, you know, the scientific credibility of the field? Glenn, do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, we ignore their advice, Colin. No, seriously, it's a translational area. I mean, you've done a phenomenal amount in this field, and you know that ultimately what we do in labs is great. It gets us research papers, hopefully more grants to explore more of our ideas. But ultimately, what pro and prebiotics do are to kind of help assist health, whether it's people or animals or whatever. So that work needs to be translated into things people or animals can use, and that means products. And the likes of you and I can't make products. We can provide basic information. So by definition, I think you need to work with industry to take the final step into the product development and get something out that people can then access. And so we have an industrial advisory committee of I think it's about 50 strong now. It's expanded each year, and they have two representatives who would come with ideas to the board of directors about what the ISC would like to see, how they would see ISAP evolving, et cetera. And that's a two-way process. We feed things back the other way. So a lot of our kind of ideas have come from that route. But yeah, we don't get into product pushing. We don't get into specific sales pitches. We don't make particular recommendations. So I guess that's how we walk that line. And if the you couldn't say that ASAP was at all biased because we work with so many different pro and pre-writer companies, a lot of which who are competitors, and not one is favored over the other.
Yeah, Mary Ellen, do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, I'd like to just weigh in that one of the things that has always struck me as we strike this balance between the academic science and the industry involvement in ISAP is that anytime it comes up where the board shows any concern about, you know what, we're going to do this just as the academic group and we're not going to include any industry members, it's the industry scientists who agree with that for the most part. They really, really value the fact that ISAP can be a voice of science and that that's the underlying principle. And they know that there's no, that in the end it would be, they'd be at cross purposes if they wanted to influence the decisions or the activities in a greater extent than they already do. So ISAP's premise has always been to keep industry a bit at an arm's length so that they don't have control over the decisions or the activities. But we've also always welcomed the fact that they have incredible input and they're exceptional scientists in their own right and that they really have so much to contribute, but there's distinctiveness between how the academic board functions and the industry input.
I've always been impressed, Mary Ellen, since my involvement with ISAP going back to 2009, that it's always been mission driven, with the mission being to advance the quality of the science in probiotics and prebiotics. Was that the mission from the very beginning? Had that been articulated?
I think it was. Glenn and Irene, do you? I'm pretty sure that was right at the start.
I recall that was called a vision statement at the start, Mary Ellen, because I can never forget whenever I hear the words mission statement or vision statement, the Dilbert cartoon, where you develop a vision statement. If that doesn't work, you replace it with a mission statement, which is the same words. So I think we did that.
Yeah. No, I think right from the start, it was really critical that we focused on the science.
From the industry perspective, how's you've met lots of people involved in the industry, of course. How do they regard ISAP, do you think? And what value does it provide to industry?
Well, you know, I arrived at the industry, in the food industry research in 97. And it really was the golden time because there was no regulation yet. So there was not this pressure of showing, of setting up dossiers, etc. And the R&D departments were only just getting off the ground in many industries, and we were much working together. It was a kind of pre-competitive atmosphere. We worked together at ILSI and at other, mixed boards. And so there was more a kind of, really science-driven interest. And I think we have maintained that over a long period of years. Of course, now it has become more difficult also because of the claim barrier. That's very important. It's also a bit a hurdle for innovation. But well, that's another subject. But indeed, when you say industry, you're talking about an umbrella thing, and marketing and business is very important for industry. But the people who work at R&D in general, they have their PhD, they have, an academic background in a given area, whether it's microbiology or medicine or nutrition or many other areas. And I think this, perhaps that ISAP for the industry members also has been a kind of, well, I don't know how to call it, but a heaven of science and being able to just follow their convictions and their own beliefs in good, reliable research.
I always think of industry and probiotics as they're the responsible actors. And then there are the somewhat irresponsible ones that come up with probiotic, you know, hair coloring. Irene, do you see it the same way, or do you feel like industry is a little bit more on the, that they're generally all responsible actors?
I think it changed quite a bit over the last 15 years, perhaps. The scientists, of course, are, well, they are first of all scientists, but often they have to obey to the marketing pressure. And that has become more difficult because of the whole regulation, the claims pressure, et cetera, which is a pity. I think it's counterproductive, but well, it's the way it is.
And prebiotics, Glenn, as you said, they've had a fair hearing, I think, within ISAP.
Yeah.
But do you think the field has received the same scientific rigor, do you think, as the probiotic field? I think it has, but
yeah,
I'd love your view.
Well, it's an interesting one, Colin. I mean, prebiotics owe their existence to probiotics. You know, you hear the term prebiotic fiber and it gets mixed up with fiber because basically the fermentable substrates, carbohydrates, essentially. But prebiotics were actually instigated because of probiotics. And I think the sort of parallel in the development has kind of really tried to follow what has happened with probiotics. And I've seen that within ISAP itself, for instance. We did the consensus paper that you led. It was firstly on probiotics, and then we did the next one on prebiotics, which very closely followed the guidelines of the successful probiotic one. And that's just one example of how I feel that pre and probiotic science has really gone together. The health outputs are the same, just rather different ways of trying to achieve them.
And back then, Mary Ellen, if you had to look forward 20 years, would you be pleased, do you think, with where probiotic and prebiotic science has got to? Or would you have expected, let's say, more products with better defined health claims? Or do you think it's still a field that's finding its way in and is where it kind of should be after 20 years of devotion to it?
That's a tough question. I think when I look at the level of rigor that has been brought to bear on many probiotic questions, be they mechanistic or clinical outcomes or kind of paving the way for new potential probiotic mediated benefits, I think there's been some really outstanding work that's been done. And I, you know, the quality of clinical trials, for example, you know, has just really improved amazingly over the years. But there's just so far to go. And there's many cases where some of the health benefits associated with probiotics are supported by research that has potentially a high risk of bias or somehow is not, you know, the studies aren't high enough quality. And I think when we look at that, that's something that we need to get beyond. And so I think there's a long way to go, both mechanistically and with the clinical trial substantiation for the evidence that, you know, we can look forward to. But I think I'm very happy with where it is today.
Glenn?
Yeah, I think it's probably exceeded my expectations, Colin, and I think there's a very good reason for that. And, you know, when I first started in the microbiome field a long, long, long time ago, it was just microbiologists who were interested. Whereas today we see big interest from molecular biologists that has allowed us to, you know, characterize a person's entire gut microbiome without inoculating a single Petri dish. And I never thought that would be at all conceivable in the 1990s. Nutritionists, biotechnologists, clinicians, you know, the list goes on and on. I think that is really what has propelled not only the microbiome area, but both the pro and the prebiotics area, these different disciplines coming in and adding weight into the field. I think if we'd have just had microbiologists involved as was happening in the 1990s, we would never have got as far as we have today. But I also feel that Mary Ellen's right. And like, you know, no scientist ever admits it's finished. You know, there is a heck of a lot still to do. And I think the last thing I would say on this one is I did try that probiotic hair colorant, but it didn't really do anything for me.
And Irene, I wanted to ask you again for an industry perspective. And as we're all scientists here, and maybe a lot of people listening are scientists, and we'd all have the same answer to this question, I think. You know, if I was an industry and I was a CEO of a company making either prebiotics or probiotics or both, and I had the choice of investing a few million into really brilliant marketing campaigns are really good science to understand the mechanisms underpinning my pre or probiotics, I'd say, you know, if my job depended on it, I might still be tempted to go the marketing route. Do you think there's a tension within the industry about, you know, maybe we don't need to know more about them, we just need to sell them better? Or do you think the industry realizes that the scientific underpinning is important? Tough question, but you can have a go at it.
It's a very tough question. I think the industry really realizes how important it is. But in the beginning, they perhaps all made a mistake in such that, food industries were not much used and not very familiar with clinical research. And of course, they knew a couple of years before that there would be requirements with, well, showing significant differences between an active compound or a product without a product compared with without a product. And that's one of the reasons that I entered at Danone, because of my experience in clinical research and many other people. But and in fact, we didn't imagine that we should have invented or constructed a different toolbox. So we started on good clinical practices, et cetera, et cetera. But a probiotic or a prebiotic is not a drug. And taking into account the influence of the food substrate, or even when you talk about a supplement, other things that are ingested at the same time, and indeed the influence not only on the gut flora, but on other enzymatic and different physiological processes, is so extremely important. And I think that that's also an area where ISAP has been very instrumental in getting people realizing that, that, well, of course, mechanisms are important, cause-effect relationships, but we should go beyond. And we have seen this over the years in all those recommendations that came out from umbrella organizations, from scientific federations, saying, oh, in this or that case, use probiotics, use prebiotics, whether it's prebiotics for allergy in infant formula or probiotics along an antibiotic treatment. And you can even think about very serious areas such as SNAC in preterm babies. And so I think it was a learning process for all of us, and we made an incredible progress. But as a scientist within R&D, and having worked a lot with scientists from other companies in R&D, no, this pressure was not a problem. Of course, you got marketing people who said, okay, we want you to show this or that with two pots of any product per day. And then you showed your results very positive with three pots. And then they said, well, that's not what we asked for. And we cannot sell a marketing message about three servings per day for or whatever. So then you explain the marketing people that research is not about buying results, but going to look for what happens. So there again, there was a lot of interaction. And I think it has been positive also for the marketing people in many aspects.
I was just wondering if Mary Ellen or Ren or Glenn had any disappointments, or were there any times in the past 20 years since this meteoric rise in publications and you know, PubMed publications and so on, that you thought the field might be turning in the wrong direction, and did it correct itself or anything like that? Like, there have been a lot of triumphs. Have there been any notable disappointments that you wanted to talk about?
I think, Dan, it's a successful field. The whole, you know, everybody, people are talking about the microbiome in all sorts of different contexts now, nowadays, including pro and prebiotics. And inevitably, when that happens, you get a lot of kind of bandwagon jumping and pseudoscience. I mean, we jokingly referred to the hair products earlier, but there's all sorts of things like bed mattresses, disinfectants, and toilet rolls, you know, and that. I mean, it's quite funny, and you can put these slides up in talks and all this sort of stuff, but it doesn't really help the credibility a great deal. And neither does this copycat business of, you know, a product being tested, whether it's a pro or prebiotic, and then the assumption made that all similar products containing LKZI or FOS or whatever behave exactly the same. So, you know, the science has progressed well, but there has been some dilution of that. And I think potentially all of us would agree that maybe the field does lack credibility in certain disciplines' eyes, and that's what we need to address. You know, we need to convince clinicians that this is important, that it's relatively harmless and could do a lot of good. But I don't know about the where you are, Dan, but here in the UK, that's really an uphill battle. And when we see this less credible business going on, that just does not help our case.
Yeah.
Another example of that has to do with fermented foods area, which is exploding right now, and I'm all for it, but there is a very large component of that field that wants to equate fermented foods with probiotics, and they just don't appreciate the fact that a food that is made with live microorganisms does not have the same level of research behind it as a properly identified microorganism that's been submitted to a rigorous clinical or intervention trial. And, you know, so I think that's another uphill battle for us. And it's a disappointment to me that people can't hold those two concepts or seemingly can't hold those two concepts separately.
And there's always the kind of dilemma almost that if, you know, two significant health advantage was demonstrated, let's say, for a probiotic being produced by an industry in food, it might have to move into the clinical field. You know, if they really showed that probiotic use in food had some really important effect in a disease state, then does it have to become a medicine? Irene, is there ever any fear that we might show that it's too good and we'd lose it?
Yeah, but that's correct, isn't it? Then we get to the area of prevention. We spoke a bit about nutrition. Which is already a difficult area because of all the various compounds and interactions that play a role. When you talk about prevention and you want to show that someone who has whatever, an IBS or not really a heavy pathology, who might get a higher degree of well-being by consuming a pre or probiotics because it acts on his microbiome, it will not be in 2 weeks. It might even be over a very long period of time. And we do not know much about the long-term effects of antibiotics given early in life. So, and this is what makes it so fascinating, because there are still so many questions and there is such a huge potential, but you all know how difficult the research is when you're in the area of prevention, because we're not working on patients, we are working on people who have perhaps a risk factor or slightly subhealthy but have not been diagnosed. So how do you want to identify them? What is the end point you are going to measure? And I think ISAP will still have a very important role to play there in the next 10, 20 years.
Yeah, I think as well, we're going to have to break down that very idea that if something is too good for you, it can't be a food anymore. You know, if I had a chronic condition, a syndrome, I would much rather treat it with a pleasant tasting food than be on tablets for the rest of my life or pills or some small molecule. So it's only a kind of convention that if a food is too good for you, it can't be a food anymore. We have to break that down. What do you think, Mary Ellen?
Yeah, I think that, you know, first of all, we have to recognize that at least in terms of how ISAP and also the FAO WHO definition describes probiotics, they can be foods or drugs or infant formulas or, you know, animal feeds. So they don't have to be restricted to the food category. And I think that this field has very clearly demonstrated that these live microorganisms can have physiological effects. And to the extent that those effects move into the drug arena, I say we embrace that. And, you know, to me, probably the bigger question, Colin, with your, you know, if you have a probiotic that is a very good therapeutic, I think, you know, the flip question on that is it safe? And to the extent that it is very safe and very effective, you know, I think that's something to embrace for the probiotic field. I think that would be great. But you can't always just assume safety. You know, something can have a very strong physiological reaction to a benefit. It has the potential for harm as well. And so that always has to be considered, especially in these newly developing areas of therapeutics.
I also note as a statistician that the kind of public health benefits of a healthier diet or the consumption of, you know, microbes that can confer health benefits, especially if it comes to preventing diseases, that requires such large sample sizes that it's really hard for any particular company to be able to fund a study for that. And it seems that there's an imperative for governments to look into that kind of research. But your career, Irene, has been notable because even though you've been an industry scientist as well as an academic, you've been able to do a lot of research characterizing public health benefits. Is that something where you feel like you have the support of the company to pursue that? Or is that feels like an uphill battle because it is so expensive to do good clinical research to show public health benefits.
Well, it's not as expensive as a clinical study. This is something that was really a surprise for many food industries when they started on clinical studies. Because, of course, when you're in a pharma company, they know that you do first some molecule screening, etc., and you might need 25 years before you get out an active drug. When you put on the market a food product, you just produce it, then you put it on the market with profit. So then they discover that recruiting patients is very long, that those clinical trials cost a lot of money, and that you are not quite sure of what you're getting. So that has been difficult, and it has been a kind of discovery. But what bothered me when the claims started to be introduced, that there was a huge focus on a specific compound within your food that would be good for you. And that kind of took off the attention from the fact that in a normal population, when you have a bit of everything in a balanced way and on a regular basis, it is adequate to ensure your good health. And that's a bit why I started this whole area on translating the effects of functional food, but also on conventional food, on the health of the human being. And then you're not talking about patients anymore. Then you're talking about the whole population. And of course, these are much more people, fortunately, even if Lancet says that now about 95% of the world population is subhealthy. But that shows how important this is, because the number of people, well, in spite of the huge, you talked about the numbers you need for research, but you also need a time frame that is so tremendously long. So at some time point, yes, we need the doctors, the pharmacists saying, okay, I believe in this, and in particular what Marianne also, there's no harm. So just try it. It might not fit you, and then you can stop. Would give it 3 months or 6 months of time to see whether it works for you. And that's common sense, but then we are leaving it kind of the area of science. So there is a very difficult in between to find and to consolidate, I think.
Yeah, I think it's very rare in science to be able to pinpoint a moment, a kind of a pinch point where a field took a step forward. I think in this case, I think the formation of ICEP was one of those moments where a science, an area kind of almost acquired rigor because of the people who put their hands up and said, I'll stand up and say, I think this is an important area. And so I think we have a lot to thank you for. ICEP is obviously an awful lot to thank you for, because it wouldn't exist without you. But I think the whole field really can look back at that moment and say that was such an important moment. So thank you to all three of you. Dan, I don't know if you want to round us off with any comments.
I also want to thank you, and I look forward to your contributions in the future, too.